While folks are getting seated, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A24-0263, State of Minnesota versus Anthony Deshaun Coleman.
Good morning. Just a reminder, you'll each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium at the center has a timer on it, as well as a button that moves the podium up and down. So feel free to adjust that. And I would ask each of you to please introduce yourselves at the beginning of your argument and identify who your client is, because we are creating recordings of the arguments that will be available on our website. Counsel, you may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant, Anthony Coleman. For purposes of the argument today, I'm going to focus on the district court's failure to instruct the jury regarding the fact that my client did not have a duty to retreat in defense of others, and the inadmissible evidence on the state's expert, use of force expert, and how that evidence shouldn't have been admitted. I am also available to answer any questions on any of the other issues raised in this appeal. According to Valdez, it is the district court's duty to instruct the jury that when a defendant is claiming defense of others, as the instruction was given in this case, the jury is supposed to be instructed that he does not have a duty to retreat. And the Supreme Court and this court has said in multiple cases that when the jury is instructed incorrectly on self-defense, that qualifies as plain error. So here, this clearly falls under the plain error standard, and the district court was required to instruct the jury in the manner that it didn't. In evaluating the error in Valdez, the court also discussed the fact that the person in peril's ability to avoid the peril is one of the things that must be evaluated. And here, both Ms. Byers and Mr. Coleman testified that upon leaving the bar at Barden's and getting outside, that they both testified that they were being shot at by DH in this situation. Fox's testimony kind of vacillated back and forth between the two trials on that point, but clearly both Mr. Coleman and Ms. Byers testified that they were being shot at. In avoiding the peril, Valdez.
But, I mean, you know, presumably in the second trial when Fox sort of changed his testimony, the jury could have believed him that your clients were not being shot at, right?
Had the jury been instructed correctly, they could potentially believe Mr. Fox's testimony, although I think the state also had him to some extent acknowledge that he had said in the first trial that DH had shot first or that they were under fire at the time. And the perspective of the person.
They never found, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Jackson, they never found the bullets from DH's gun, right?
That's correct.
Or the bullet holes?
That's correct. Okay. But we also don't know what direction DH was shooting. He potentially could have been shooting.
In the air?
In the air, and they hear fire coming.
So if I shoot in the air right now,
yep.
Do you get to shoot all of us?
Well, I can see you clearly because we're in a lighted courtroom. This was in the middle of the night. DH was parked somewhat far away. He was sitting there waiting.
Well, all the more reason that your client shouldn't return fire. In the middle of the night, in darkness, I get to just fire back in what I think is the general direction of someone who might have shot at me, but maybe did not.
Well, I think if we look at the concurrence in the Valdez opinion from the Court of Appeals, Judge Kirk pointed out that it's not that easy to make those determinations when you're in the middle of somebody shooting at you. When you hear gunshots coming your way, you don't get to have the same reflection.
Valdez is I know what Valdez says, believe me. You know, I just wrote an opinion that was released yesterday. But, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Valdez, it was breaking into someone's home, and while someone, perhaps I'm wrong, you know, the shooting at the person was while I'm seeing you strangle someone, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So, I mean, that seems to me a more clear example of having the right to defend others if I, you know, as opposed to, well, I'll call the police now and, you know, call 911 while you continue strangling someone. I mean, I just am not so sure if Valdez applies to these facts. Now, you tell me why I'm wrong, Mr. Axelson.
Well, I would say that Valdez applies to any case where there is a defense of others claim, that it is a broad swath, essentially, of any defense of others claim, there is no duty to retreat ever. Here, we also don't have a jury who's been instructed on this peril language that's discussed in Valdez. The jury was not given this alternative of potentially did he have the opportunity to avoid the peril in this situation. So we don't have a jury that's instructed on either one of those points.
Is there a distinction between the peril that was present to your client and the peril that was present to the others for purposes of needing a Valdez-type instruction?
Well, there...
I'm curious as to whether the error in instructing the jury is harmless under the circumstances where it seems like the peril is the same presented to both.
Well, the defense is applied for both, so I agree that he's also in the same peril as the other group. But, you know, under the Baird standard, which is discussed in Valdez, we don't know if the jury's not properly instructed, if they had the ability to just stop the process because they find the jury could have stopped clearly at the point where they say, well, he's not in his home, so he has a duty to retreat and the other people have a duty to retreat. So I think it the jury's not instructed correctly on both. We can't just evaluate it based on assuming that the jury just rejected his defense of himself. They may have also had they didn't also have the opportunity to decide whether or not he was defending the other people who were in peril. And again, that's from his perspective. So Mrs. Byers' testimony that she was able to avoid the peril in the situation, he doesn't know about that, and he testifies that he doesn't know Mrs. Byers isn't present until after the shooting is complete. And again, I agree that this is not as clear-cut as Valdez, because in Valdez, he's watching this person who's on top of the person who's in peril, but in a situation where somebody is shooting a gun, I think that is a more chaotic scene where you don't have a lot of time to make a decision when you know that you're being shot at. I also don't think that the state's reliance on the lack of bullets being found, again, because they didn't find every single bullet that Mr. Coleman shot at DH in this situation. We also know that DH returned to his home. He lied about the facts of this case and said that one of the people had stuck their arm inside of his car. And clearly from the surveillance video, that didn't happen. DH said that he never possessed guns, even though multiple witnesses testified that just a week or so earlier he had possessed a gun and had threatened these people with that gun. We know that that the police didn't search his car immediately, and that they actually left the scene and left DH alone. They never searched his home to figure out if the shell casings from him shooting at Ms. Byers and Mr. Fox and my client were not found in that car, because, again, they didn't do the regular investigation that they should have done in this case. So when this court evaluates the prejudice here, again, there are plenty of examples of why my client was acting in the defense of the other people in this case, and had the jury been properly instructed under Baird, we don't know how they would have ruled in his favor on that point. Moving on to the...
Right, before you move on, is it relevant here that there was also testimony that the DH would not have shot toward Ms. Byers? Right, I mean, couldn't the jury have credited that testimony in that case? Then your argument about the instruction for defense of others is not prejudicial.
Well, I argued in my brief that I thought that was an improper speculation, and there was an objection to that Mr. Fox doesn't have the ability to guess what's in the mind of DH. DH did not testify that I wouldn't shoot at this group because I saw Ms. Byers out there. I don't think DH saw Ms. Byers at all. I think he identified Mr. Fox as the person who was shooting. And so, again, that was pure speculation on Mr. Fox's part, and I don't believe that this court can rely on that speculation. Additionally, when you're evaluating harmless error and you look at the Baird standard, you wouldn't just look at this from the state's perspective of their viewpoint. This isn't a sufficiency claim. And so you would look at, you would credit Mr. Coleman's testimony, you would credit Ms. Byers' testimony, and to some extent Mr. Fox's testimony that supports my client's claim that he was acting in defense of the others. Regarding the use of force expert in this case.
Can I actually ask you to talk about prosecutorial misconduct for a moment and
sure.
the closing argument?
Yeah.
I am troubled by the statements in closing argument about public safety, vigilante justice, I would like you to tell me why the errors in closing argument affect the fairness and integrity of the proceedings.
Well, I think you can look at all of these things in one big system, and that's part of the reason we made the argument about the cumulative error here. And again, we have a jury that's not instructed correctly. We have a use of force expert that's totally inappropriate to call based on State v. Post. And then we have a prosecutor who's ramping up her closing arguments from the first trial to the second trial, talking about vigilante justice, talking about the sanctity of their small town. And I think that this court and the Supreme Court has said on multiple occasions that prosecutors are not supposed to kind of tip the balance in cases by using what's been prescribed as improper arguments in the past in order to try to prove their case.
So the thing that is most troubling to me is that the jury hung the first time on this count, and it seems to be particularly egregious, in my view, to invoke passion and prejudice of the jury in closing argument to try to correct what the state was unable to achieve in the first trial. Is there some authority that addresses that type of situation? I was unable to find any, but I'm asking you as the expert in the matter to help me out here.
I mean, this is a pretty unique case that I have here, and practicing for over 22 years, I haven't seen very similar cases where the jury is hung on the middle count and the jury acquits on the top count and only convicts on the bottom count. And then we have a second trial where, at least from my perspective in doing this for many years, the state seems to really ramp up what they're trying to do in that second trial. You know, the use of force expert is not called in the first trial. Although there is the same attempt to appeal to the sympathies in the first trial, that I believe the vigilante justice is added in the second trial, and the attempt to appeal to the sympathies, I think, is ramped up also in the second trial. So I think this court does have the perspective, knowing that at least one jury, acquitted on the top count, hung on the second count, and only convicted on a lesser count. So this is not an overwhelming case in the state's favor, and this is a case where little things and combined together could be the prejudicial factor in why my client was denied a fair trial.
But even if we agree with you that his substantial rights were affected, speak to, and I think this is just exactly what my colleague just asked you, speak to the fourth prong, that if we agree with you, if we think you've shown that, how should we then evaluate that final factor of ensuring fairness and the integrity of the judicial proceedings?
Well, in Ramey, I think the Supreme Court made it very clear what the effect they believe prosecutorial misconduct can have in cases. And there is very little discussion in Ramey on that fourth prong. And I think in prosecutorial misconduct cases, although that fourth prong still exists under Griller, I think it's pretty easy to meet when that's the error that we're talking about. And I think all the errors,
the kind of cases where it seems that the fourth prong, you get past the finish line on the fourth prong, or where there's an erroneous, shifting of burdens of the presumption of innocence, things of that nature. And I think, at least my concern is that while these statements are concerning, we're not in the same family as those kinds of errors, those kinds of structural comments during closing argument to shift the burden of proof.
I'm also not aware of any case where this court or the Supreme Court has said that you know, where they have in some cases found errors harmless or didn't affect substantial rights, but I've not seen a loss on the fourth prong where they said, yes, this affected substantial rights, yes, this was not harmless, but we're going to find on the fourth prong that it doesn't meet the standard. I don't think that that's usually the, typically the linchpin, at least in my experience with arguing successfully, including being the attorney in Ramey, on that fourth prong. And I think that there's an argument that in Ramey, both in the Supreme Court opinion and in the when it gets remanded back down to the Court of Appeals, that the prejudicial misconduct in Ramey is not as bad as the misconduct in this case. And I think that the, again, I'll probably get more into this in my rebuttal, but I think that the use of force expert in this case is particularly troubling, especially because the state gave its word when this was being discussed and when defense counsel argued that this should not go into, this should not affect the self-defense standard that's provided to the jury. And that's exactly the way the state used it in both their examination of this expert and in closing argument. But I'll save the rest of that for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, we'll now move on to the counsel for respondent, and feel free to adjust the podium. The clock has been reset, so you may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning for Respondent, the State of Minnesota. This Court should affirm the conviction for attempted intentional second-degree murder, and it should reject each of appellant's claims of error. This morning, like my friend did, I plan to focus on two issues, the jury instruction issue with respect to the duty to retreat, as well as some of the firearm instructors' testimony, but I do want to begin with Valdez, and I want to make three points in particular about Valdez. The first point I want to make, just sort of as a threshold point, is that every word about Valdez that we heard this morning, we are hearing for the first time. Appellant didn't have the benefit of the Supreme Court's decision when drafting their brief. Perfectly understandable. Appellant then elected not to file a reply brief, which is the opportunity to address the new decision. So every word about Valdez is new this morning. The second point I want to make is I want to emphasize a major difference between this case and Valdez. And that is that in this case, unlike in Valdez, the appellant raised both self-defense and defense of others. So it is fundamentally untrue to say that there was no duty to retreat in this case. If appellant was acting in defense of himself, he did have a duty to retreat.
Was the duty to retreat the same with regards to the self-defense as it was with the defense of others?
I think in terms of the way you would phrase an instruction, I think under Valdez, you should probably be giving, in a case like this, two different duty to retreat instructions. And the second one would be phrased a little differently. So it would be phrased in terms of the ability of the person in peril to retreat, viewed from the perspective of the defendant. That's the rule of law from Valdez. But duty retreat is still relevant. And on the facts of this case in particular, when, as I believe some of the questions observed during the appellant's argument, when you have the person using defensive force standing roughly beside their companions, the danger to those two people, to those two sets of people, is equivalent. And so if there is a duty for the defendant to retreat, which undisputably there was before he acts in defense of himself, and the question under Valdez is, what is the ability of the others to retreat? If they're in the same situation, the duty applies the same. So that's sort of like the heart of what...
Including the duty to retreat?
What the duty is for them to attempt to retreat before appellant can use defensive force. He cannot use defensive force under Valdez if, from his perspective, there is an opportunity for the others to retreat.
And what's the authority for that proposition, that a duty to retreat that may apply to the defendant is imputed to others who are in peril.
What, Your Honor, I think that's the rule of law from Valdez. So the court first knocked out this idea that there was a duty to retreat personally for the defendant. That's the first part of Valdez. And then the court said, but that does not end our inquiry in this case. And so the second part of Valdez explains that their retreat is still relevant. And the relevant consideration is from the defendant's perspective, and that's in the final footnote of the opinion where the court lays out the defendant's perspective, does the person in peril have an opportunity to retreat? So you still give the instruction. You give a duty to retreat instruction. Maybe we wouldn't call it a duty to retreat because it's not personal on the defendant, but the ability of the others to retreat is still relevant. And the point I really want to emphasize is if appellant had a duty to retreat, and if the if retreat is relevant to his ability to use defense with respect to the others, and they're under the same danger, then I don't think that a reasonable jury who was properly instructed would say the defendant had a duty to retreat in defense of himself, but retreat was not relevant with respect to the others. I think in this case, on these facts, a rational jury would arrive at the same conclusion on those questions had they been properly instructed. I also want to emphasize, however, that we're under plain error, and precisely because we're having all these questions about how does Valdez apply, what is the nature of how a jury should be instructed in this unique circumstance, I do think appellant hasn't even carried his burden to demonstrate plain error. We need precedent, and we don't have it. And then, in addition, if the court does reach the substantial rights inquiry under Valdez, we have the strength of the state's case, and particularly the fact that the state's theory, which I think is pretty strongly supported by the evidence, was that there was no other shooter in this case. Appellant was the only shooter. And so we have a strong case on that point before the jury would even reach self-defense. If they concluded there was no other shooter, there's no even reason to be for the jury to be deliberating about any of this.
I'm not so sure that it's the evidence is as strong as you're suggesting that it is. It does seem that it came down to a credibility determination about whether or not Mr. Coleman was telling the truth. You know, the fact that there was an absence of bullet casings, et cetera, or proof of shots being fired towards the back of the bar is just that they weren't able to find it. I think that's what you're opposing counsel would say.
Correct. And, Your Honor, I think this didn't get any play in the briefs, but I think we're all aware of State versus Big Bear. It's not a jury instruction case, but it's still about a prejudicial impact inquiry. And what the court said in Big Bear is on the strength of the state's evidence, the court looks exclusively at the evidence of guilt. It doesn't weigh the defense favorable evidence against the state's evidence. On this one factor, the strength of the evidence, Big Bear says we look only at the evidence of guilt. And so if that's our analysis, that's what Big Bear says, that's our position on how strong our case was. But then we also have the fact about what I argued earlier, about what we think a reasonable jury would have concluded had they been properly instructed in this case. And that's because all of the people were operating under the same threat. A jury who concluded that Mr. Coleman had an opportunity to retreat would have reached the same conclusion with respect to the ability of the others to retreat. I think that, in addition to going to plain error, I think that goes to the substantial rights inquiry. Before getting to some of the evidentiary disputes, since this also got some play in appellant's argument, I did want to address misconduct.
Could you tell us how the state satisfied its burden to establish that the misconduct during the trial or during the closing argument did not have that there's no reasonable likelihood that the absence of the misconduct had a significant effect on the verdict?
Certainly, Your Honor. So again, I
didn't see it in the brief.
I'm sorry, were you asking about
I didn't see any argument about satisfying the state's burden in your brief.
On prong three?
Yeah.
I believe I did. If I didn't make an argument that it was, if I didn't make any prejudice argument that was in error. But what I would say is that, again, look
prosecutors at... Prosecutors don't have to make colorless arguments? Is that the argument?
Well, that would be the argument on error. You know, I don't think this was error because when I read the prosecutor's argument, Your Honor, you referenced sanctity, or either you or appellant's counsel.
What's the legitimate purpose for the prosecutor to say that people can't be shooting at other people in downtown Waseca, the heart of Waseca, in a residential area? There's patrons of the businesses that are out and about. It's the most heavily populated area. What is the legitimate purpose in, and that, and it goes on and on.
So if you look at the cases that appellant cites, the error is using the verdict to achieve some collateral purpose. So there's a case about we have to protect safety in our town. That's not what the prosecutor said here. The prosecutor is focused on appellant's conduct. Shooting in the downtown area is dangerous. I don't think that's overly inflammatory to emphasize that.
Doesn't it also go, Mr. Stockmore, to the reasonableness of the defendant's actions relevant to a duty to retreat or a duty to defend, or a duty to provide self-defense of others? You have to act reasonably. And I viewed that argument as going to, well, it's not reasonable just to start shooting back in a crowded area, downtown Waseca, blah, blah, blah.
I appreciate that point, Your Honor. I agree with that would play into both a harmless error inquiry or a substantial rights inquiry and whether the argument was proper. But the reason I addressed this in the first place, Judge Frisch, is I wanted to address the substantial rights inquiry. And one of the cases that appellant cites in their brief is State versus Merrill. And in Merrill, it was a pretty egregious amount of prosecutorial misconduct in closing argument. So the prosecutor observed that the victim, there was an empty wheelchair, and the victim was unable to speak for themselves. The prosecutor characterized the defendant as an animal. The prosecutor stated that the other witnesses in the case had all led crime-free lives, so obviously vouching for those witnesses relative to the defendant. The prosecutor asked the jury to pass a message to the defendant that we don't approve of this type of conduct. And again, that references my original argument about the nature of this argument. It didn't say use your verdict to achieve some collateral purpose. So I think if we're looking at
the most
substantial
thing in Merrill, that even with all of those horrible things, which I think are far more egregious than in this case, they still affirmed.
Correct. That was exactly my point, Your Honor. Merrill affirmed.
Although they did tell the prosecutor, don't ever do this again. And
correct.
If you do,
there certainly was some language in Merrill about that.
I think there were subsequent cases that were not as generous.
Your Honor, it's still good law, and if
it's not proper for the prosecutor to invoke public safety as a generalized concern in order to secure a verdict, is it?
As a generalized concern unconnected from the defendant's conduct, I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Then how do we justify comments about vigilante justice and Waseca thankfully does not have many shootings, but we're also a small town where we don't have many officers on duty at one time. So I mean, we've got a couple of problems there, personalizing and connecting to the prosecutor to the jury in the town.
Right. I think the latter part of that was in reference to the defense argument in closing about not all the bullets were found. I think that's what that is being tethered to. The first part that you just mentioned, the vigilante justice. We cited a non-precedential decision in our brief. Basically, if it fits the facts of the case, the state is allowed to present that theory. And in this particular case, where the defense evidence established that the victim and the victim's brother had each pulled guns on the defendant and the defendant's friends 11 days earlier, none of the people involved in those incidents called the police, and then the defendant, on the state's theory, walks out of a bar and shoots at that same victim. That is vigilantism. And so the theory of the state's case fit that term. In terms of the inflammatory nature of that term, again, I'm going to turn to precedent. We have State versus Radke, where the prosecution compared the defendant to Rambo. And so I just don't think appellant can demonstrate plain error on the nature of the argument under the precedent we've cited.
Counsel, you just have a few minutes left. I'm going to ask you to move to the discussion about the witness that testified about use of force. I believe that was the instructor.
The firearms instructor, yes, Your Honor. So one thing I want to clarify is the instructor did not testify about use of force. So the objection below, the only objection below, was an objection to, we don't want this person giving the jury a standard for what a person facing this threat would do. What would a reasonable person do who's facing this threat in the moment? There was no testimony about that. That is not the claim of error on appeal, and so we're in the plain error world. What the instructor testified to was relevant to the appellant's state of mind, which is relevant to his defense of others and self-defense claims. Because the instructor said, this is what I teach my students to do in the event that they use force. When you look at that testimony and compare it to what appellant did when he was interacting with the arresting officers, you would expect, if he had a bona fide belief that this was a lawful use of force, he may have followed those instructions. But he didn't. Instead, he interrogated the police about what they knew about the shooting. He's quite clearly trying to dig up information. And so the relevance of this testimony goes to his state of mind at that point in time.
Can you address, if we were to determine that it was in fact plain error, how it did not affect his substantial rights?
Yes, Your Honor. So, again, our position is we had a strong case, and for the reasons I explained to Your Honor earlier under Big Bear. I think the heart, as I just explained, the heart of this testimony is about what appellant told the police, what he didn't tell the police, and him not complying or not following the advice of the instructor. In closing argument, page 613, the defense does rebut that to some extent. They talk about, well, nobody who was here told the police about anything that was going on. People don't always tell the police what happened. So the defense had some ability to rebut that, and then they did. I also think that in closing argument, this was properly framed. And so if you turn to page 602 of the transcript, appellant's quotation in the brief, I think, starts with the words, it doesn't make any sense, that he learned in his class going forward. But if you look immediately before that, so remember, you know, the comments that you could hear Mr. Coleman saying, and again, this is on the recording, at Barden's bar, who got shot? What car? Did our car get shot? Did you see us shoot? Those are things that you can hear Mr. Coleman saying in the squad video. And then towards the end of the paragraph, the prosecutor says, you wouldn't do any of that unless you were guilty of a crime. So I read the prosecutor as properly framing this in the way that I said earlier. The prosecutor is connecting what the instructor said to comparing it to what Mr. Coleman did on the video and saying, that's not how you would behave if you had a bona fide belief that you had used force reasonably. So I think if you go through those factors, the traditional prejudicial impact factors, the conclusion is appellant hasn't satisfied his burden, and we simply ask this court to affirm the conviction.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you again. We will return to counsel for appellant for 5 minutes of rebuttal, and clock is reset. You can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. I actually totally disagree on his last point regarding what the prosecutor said in her closing argument on that point. She is specifically using the use of force instructor's interpretation of what somebody would do had they acted lawfully in self-defense afterwards, and then attempted to undercut every single thing that Mr. Coleman did and link it back to this improper expert. Again, this is the exact same thing that happened in the Post decision. We have a case directly on point. I know that doesn't involve a use of expert witness, but involves a manual that essentially says the same thing. State
so
doesn't even
while
point.
It does seem that the testimony may have established a standard that the jury was inclined to believe applied here. I guess I'm wondering if you can speak to whether or not the was this testimony truly about what was taught to appellant? Was it, or because you're referring to it as expert testimony.
Yes.
And the state's position is that it's, in fact, not expert testimony, but testimony about their his personal knowledge of their interactions.
Well, I think they can call it a fact witness as much as they want, but it's exactly what it was introduced for, is not as a fact witness. The state specifically said that they weren't going to introduce it to show what Coleman should have done, and that's exactly what they used it for. I think probably the most troubling part of this expert's testimony is the reference to alcohol, and which again, Post specifically says is not proper, and it's not in the self-defense instruction, but the expert said the main reason is how it would be interpreted by the law. He's talking about the law, or by the jury actually, is where it really goes down for me. Even trace amounts of alcohol can bring a jury member to have you fail the reasonable person test, basically. Had he not said any of the other things, that there, right there, is a person who's supposed to be an expert on use of force, who's just told the jury that because my client had alcohol that day, he could not act in self-defense. So when you tie that together with the error from the first component of it, is even if the state wants to try to link because all these people are outside at the same time, but if the jury is going to shut down on the ability to grant my client the right to self-defense because he has alcohol in his system, they're not going to even evaluate any of the other components of this case. But we tie that statement and the additional statements to what happens in the wrong instruction on the duty to retreat. And that error is prejudicial and is the problem in this case. I just wanted to speak quickly on Big Bear, too. Is Baird, which is the case that Valdez relies on. Valdez and Big Bear are decided within a couple of months of each other or within a year of each other. There is not that same focus on, as the state puts it, the strength of the state's evidence. The focus on Baird and in Valdez is on, let's see if I have the exact term, simply impossible to determine whether the jury rejected Baird's version of self-defense or accepted his version but found that he was guilty because he failed to retreat. So that is the focus in Baird, that's the focus in Valdez, and that's the focus by this court regarding that component. I also want to focus on the, because we haven't discussed it, even though I didn't say we were going to discuss it, but because we are talking about prosecutorial misconduct, the introduction of the fear evidence is May stands for the proposition, and again, I was the attorney in that case and argued it before the Supreme Court, is that in that case, they rejected that fear evidence is admissible for general credibility. I know that the state cites that in their brief from a previous decision, but that
wasn't
was
it used
dicta.
Here to specifically respond to the inconsistent prior testimony that
well,
was given by
his
that witness?
Testimony gets better for the state in the second trial, so there would be no need to account for his testimony getting more favorable to the state. The fear evidence is the many cases that have come before are situations where a person is reluctant at a second trial to testify against somebody, or they change the story and the state is trying to account for why they would change the story and it would no longer be favorable for the state. That's the exact opposite of what happens here. They love Fox's testimony from the second trial because he doesn't say that that DH shot first or that he heard gunfire in the air when Mr. Coleman returns fire. There would be no use for the fear evidence in the second trial whatsoever, and that makes it especially prejudicial combined with all the other errors in this case. So,
do you have any authority for the proposition that we would treat it differently simply because, as you pointed out, it was sort of the reverse situation?
Well, if you allow me to
yes.
Answer. Yep. Again, if you look at the fear cases, there's not a single one, and again, because I was the attorney in May, there's not a single fear case that says when the evidence is more favorable for the state on retrial or if the witness is coming forward and has no issues coming forward, that somehow fear evidence is just automatically admissible for credibility. And May specifically rejected that it just comes in for basic credibility.
Thank you again to both counsel for a very well-argued and briefed case. The case is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame.